Bibles, if you would, to Daniel chapter 10. Daniel chapter 10. I want to spend a few minutes, and it might be the rest of tonight's lesson, and that just puts it a half lesson behind, but that's all right. We can catch up next week. I always say that, and I never do, but you know, hope springs eternal. What can I say? I want to talk about the question of territorial spirits. Probably over the last 25 years, there has not been a more controversial subject among Christians who deal with the issue of spiritual warfare than are there such things as territorial demonic spirits? And if there are, what do they do and what should we do in response, if anything? So I'm going to say a few words about that tonight. The question I'm asking, if you're saying, I've never heard this language, territorial spirits, what in the world does that mean? Notice if you at the top of the notes there under lesson 5. Has Satan assigned specific demons special responsibility, authority, and power over specific geographical and political areas? Could the entrenched resistance to the gospel in some nations and cultures be due to the ruling presence of a demonic spirit or spirits placed there by Satan? If so, what is the responsibility of the Christian? Is there a unique form of spiritual warfare calling for special tactics when it comes to dealing with so-called territorial spirits? In other words, think for a moment of areas, even in the state of Oklahoma, more broadly speaking, in the U.S., that you have visited, that when you were there, you just were remarkably sensible and aware of a powerful demonic presence. I've had this happen a few times in certain areas. One vividly comes to mind is when a friend of mine and I were ministering up in Canada, and we went onto the land that had always been owned and operated and still was under the oversight of a Native American tribe, and it was devoted to totem poles, and all of the worship surrounding their particular form of earth religion. It was one of the most oppressive atmospheres I've ever been in. It was just the heaviness, the darkness, the struggle to even speak was powerful. Certain cities in the U.S. just seem to be entrenched in an extraordinary way in darkness and immorality and resistance to the gospel. You look around the globe, there are certain nations that are uniquely and extraordinarily in bondage to the enemy and resistant to the gospel. And so the suggestion has been made, could it be that this is because Satan has assigned certain demonic spirits to concentrate their efforts in a particular geographical area, maybe over a particular political dynamic or a sociocultural realm or some other dimension of society? And if that is true, does that change the way that we respond in terms of our responsibility as Christian men and women? That's the issue we're dealing with here. Now, I believe there is biblical evidence for the existence of what we're calling territorial spirits. Now, the language territorial spirits doesn't occur in the Bible. That's our language for trying to account for this. Just a few things mentioned quickly. Certainly we know that Satan has organized his demons into a hierarchy. We looked at this last week. We know that demons differ in their degree or depth of wickedness and their strength or power. We know that Satan does not operate haphazardly, that he has a strategic plan. When you add all that to what we read in Daniel 10 and some other texts, I think, and I deviate from a lot of my evangelical friends, I think there is biblical grounds for recognizing the existence of territorial demonic spirits. Excuse me. So we want to look at this in Daniel chapter 10. This is an incredible chapter, and there's simply no way to do this other than just simply reading this chapter and working through it a little bit by little bit. And I'm going to skip over some portions, but there are a number of things here I just need to highlight for you. You can read a lot of this in the notes. Verse 1, Daniel chapter 10. By the way, Daniel is about 85 years old at this time. Still going strong. Don't you love it? Still just, you know, having angelic encounters and battling the enemy at 85. I hope I'm doing that if I'm 85. I hope I'm not 85, but in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a word was revealed to Daniel, who was named Belteshazzar. And the word was true, and it was a great conflict. And he understood the word and had understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 weeks. I ate no delicacies, no meat or wine entered my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all for the full 3 weeks. On the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a man clothed in linen with a belt of fine gold from Uphaz around his waist. His body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and the sound of his words like the sound of a multitude. Now, I'm not going to go into it. I describe all these features on the next page. There's a debate. Is this the pre-incarnate Son of God? Is this some other angelic being? Excuse me. I think it's Gabriel, but I could be wrong, but I think it's Gabriel. Verse 7. And I, Daniel, alone saw the vision. For the men who were with me did not see the vision, but a great trembling fell upon them, and they fled to hide themselves. This is fascinating just in and of itself, by the way. In other words, what Daniel is telling us is that you could be in a group of people, and all of them could be believers, and only one individual is permitted by God to see this vision. But the others know that something supernatural and revelatory is occurring to the degree that they just lose their composure. So that's very interesting just in terms of helping us understand the nature of these kind of revelatory supernatural events. But we can't stay there. We've got to move on. So I was left alone and saw this great vision, and no strength was left in me. My radiant appearance was fearfully changed, and I retained no strength. Then I heard the sound of his words, and as I heard the sound of his words, I fell on my face in deep sleep with my face to the ground. And behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. It's interesting. I hear people say angelic or demonic beings cannot make any kind of physiological contact with humans. Well, duh, there it is, okay? In fact, it's going to happen again in just a moment, so that's not true. They can. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly loved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for now I have been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. Then he said to me, fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. Now, folks, you got to think about this. Think what's happening. Daniel starts praying. He's fasting. He's devoting himself intensely to understand this, the revelation of this conflict that God has made known to him. And he prays unto the Lord. And at that very moment, God commissions Gabriel to go to Daniel, but he's delayed. This is fascinating. I have come because of your words. Verse 15 or verse 13, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. So here's Gabriel coming to Daniel, sent by God in response to Daniel's prayer. Now notice, Daniel does not pray to Gabriel. There's no evidence that anybody ever prays to an angel in the Bible. They pray to God. God hears the prayer, commissions an angel to go to Daniel. And Gabriel says, I would have been here 3 weeks earlier. That's what he's saying. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me. Let's continue. But Michael, one of the chief princes, so here's the archangel, Michael comes to the rescue. He came to help me, for I was left there with the kings of Persia and came to make you understand what is to happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision is for the days yet to come. So Gabriel says, I was on my way. I know you thought God didn't hear your prayer. Isn't that interesting? 3 week delay in the answer to the prayer. And it turns out it's because the angel who was commissioned to communicate with Daniel from God, the truth of what is about to happen, was held up by this battle that's going on between him and another demonic and a demonic spirit. Gabriel had to come after, and you wonder, why did God wait 21 days before he sent Michael to help Gabriel? I mean, do you ask those kinds of questions like I do? But for whatever reason, God finally sends Michael. Michael helps Gabriel. Gabriel overcomes the prince of Persia. He comes to Daniel. When he had spoken to me according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and was mute. Well, I would be too. And behold, one in the likeness of the children of man touched my lips. Now, again, I think this is probably still Gabriel. Some say it's another angel. Some say it's the pre-incarnate Christ. I think it's probably Gabriel. Notice again, he touches his lips. He's making contact with him. Then I opened my mouth and spoke. I said to him who stood before me, O my Lord, and by the way, Lord there isn't used in the sense of Kurios, Lord, in the New Testament. It's simply a term of respect. It's like sir. O my Lord, by reason of the vision, pains have come upon me, and I retain no strength. How can my Lord's servant talk with my Lord? For now no strength remains in me, and no breath is left in me. Again, one having the appearance of a man touched me and strengthened me. So again, third time he makes contact with Daniel, and the angel actually infuses strength, physical as well as spiritual strength into him. This, by the way, is probably what happened. Remember in Luke's gospel where it says after, and Matthew, after the temptation of Jesus by the devil, the angels came and ministered to him. They strengthened him. And he said to me, O man greatly loved, fear not, peace be with you, be strong and of good courage. And as he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. Then he said, Do you know why I have come to you? But now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia. So he said, you know, Michael helped me overcome him, but this isn't over. I'm going back. I'm going to take him on yet again. And when I go out, behold, the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. There is none who contends by my side against these, referring to the prince of Greece and the prince of Persia, except Michael, your prince. Now, chapter 11, verse 1, all Old Testament scholars recognize is actually ought to be the last verse of chapter 10. It goes with chapter 10. And as for me, this is still Gabriel talking. In the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him, a reference to Michael. So I won't go into this, but Gabriel is saying, not only did Michael come and help me, but there was an occasion in the first year when Darius came to power that I went and I confirmed and strengthened Michael. Mutual support on the part of the angels here. Is that not one of the weirdest chapters in the Bible you've ever read? I love it. It's just great. All right, let's figure out what in the heck he's talking about. Let's turn, if we to the top of page 3 in your notes. You can read some of the other material later. In response to his humility and prayer, God sent an angel to Daniel. His arrival was delayed 21 days because he had been hindered by the prince of the kingdom of Persia. Who or what is the prince of Persia? Well, he has to be an angelic or demonic being. Here's why. Number one, he is able to resist this exalted angelic being. In other words, the prince of Persia could resist Gabriel. That's not something just some ordinary ruler on earth could do. In fact, he is able to resist with such force that Michael had to be summoned for help. Also, the word prince that is used here is applied to Michael, who we know is an angel. Therefore, he must be demonic in nature. Why? Because he engages in conflict with a holy angel. He sustains an ongoing relationship to the nation of Persia. It seems clear that this must be a ruling principality, an especially powerful demonic spirit that Satan has assigned to influence the kingdom of Persia and the development and the activities of this particular nation. Let me skip down to the middle of that page. I'm just kind of summing up major points here. Several conclusions. First, it's important to note that Daniel is nowhere portrayed as praying to or commanding angels. I hope you get that. I know a lot of Christians fall into that error, and we need to be careful. His prayer is directed to God alone, who in turn commissions his angelic host to engage in the conflict on Daniel's behalf. Second, we clearly see that the demonic hosts are engaged in warfare with the angelic host of heaven. The prize, as it were, being the opportunity to manipulate earthly kings, nations, and peoples. Let me skip down. You can need to read that comment that just explains further. Third, Daniel's prayer did, in fact, provoke a heavenly conflict. The fact that Daniel's three-week fast coincides with the three-week struggle between the prince of Persia and the unnamed angel demonstrates a relationship between human intercession and what happens on a higher plane. Daniel's prayers appear to influence angels who play a significant role in shaping the destinies of nations. It's so easy for us to think, oh man, I pray, I fast, I don't see anything that's happening, God isn't hearing me, nothing's occurring. What do you think Daniel was wondering during those 3 weeks? And yet we are told that his prayers actually provoked a massive conflict in the angelic realm, the result of which, the outcome of which, affects the events of nations on the earth. You think for a moment just about the simple command in 1 Timothy 2 that we are to pray for kings and all who are in authority. When we really do that, what happens? Well, we don't know. We don't necessarily see it. But could it be the grounds that lead to, or the cause that ultimately results in, angelic ministries in ways that we can't see, that is resisted by demonic forces? I don't know, but it seems that that is certainly the case here with Daniel. This is important for us to remember. I ask the question here, does this suggest that the outcome of the heavenly conflict is dependent on the frequency or fervency of one's prayers on earth? It would seem possibly so. Clinton Arnold points out, very important, Daniel himself had no idea of what was happening in the spiritual realm as he prayed. He didn't know that this was happening between Gabriel and the prince of Persia, nor that Michael had to come and assist him. There's no indication that Daniel was attempting to discern territorial spirits, pray against them, or cast them down. In fact, Daniel only learned about what had happened in the angelic realm after the warring in heaven. So in other words, there's no basis here for drawing the conclusion that Daniel came to this time of prayer and fasting saying to himself, well, there is an extraordinarily powerful demon who's been assigned by Satan to influence the kingdom of Persia and maybe even one over Greece. And so I'm going to pray to God, or I'm going to invoke the assistance of angels, or I'm going to take a stand in such a way that I engage with that prince of Persia or that prince of Greece and bring it down. That's not here. And unfortunately, many who have engaged in what I'll explain in a moment is called strategic spiritual warfare have thought that what this chapter gives them warrant or authority to do is to go out and to explore the possibility of the existence of these territorial spirits and then directly engage them in some sort of spiritual conflict. There's just nothing to that effect in this chapter. But we'll come back to that in just a moment. Fourth, the outcome of battles and struggles on earth reflects the involvement of heaven. The purposes of kings and nations, notes John Goldengay, are more than merely the decisions of particular human beings. Something in the realm of the spirit lies behind them. In other words, the unfolding events in human history are not determined solely by the will of human beings. Sidney Page says this, quote, "In particular, there are malevolent forces in the universe that exercise a baneful influence in the socio-political realm, especially where the people of God are concerned. Nevertheless, the power of these evil agencies is limited, for transcendent powers of goodness oppose them, and the faithful prayers of believers are also effective against them. However antagonistic the forces of evil may be towards the will of God," and that should be capital G, "they cannot prevent it from being accomplished." One more observation, and then I'm going to talk about other evidence for territorial spirits. Clinton Arnold makes a very interesting observation here. He says, the events of Daniel 10 took place in 535 BC. On the human plane, the Greek Empire did not surface to prominence until the rise of Alexander the Great, almost exactly 200 years later. For the next two centuries, the Persian Empire remained the dominant power in the ancient Near East. It is important then to observe that the text does not teach that Daniel, by his prayer, was able to bind, cast down, or evict the Persian prince. He remains powerfully influential for 200 years. Of course, casting down a territorial ruler was not the objective of Daniel's prayer anyway. Now, make sure you understand what's happening here. Daniel prays. God commissions Gabriel to come to him. Gabriel is confronted by this demonic spirit who has authority over the realm of Persia. Gabriel, with the help of Michael, prevails over him, comes and ministers to Daniel, then says, I got to go back and continue this battle against the prince of Persia, this demonic spirit. And yet we know from history that Persia ruled for another 200 years. There's no indication that Daniel did anything to, quote unquote, pull down or somehow defeat the prince of Persia, because the power of Greece under Alexander didn't emerge for another 200 years. So important to remember these kinds of details so you don't end up drawing false conclusions about what either is or is not possible in the area of spiritual warfare. Now, a couple other comments about additional biblical support for territorial spirits. Oftentimes, by the way, it would seem to me, if all I have is Daniel 10, that's sufficient enough to tell me that this kind of demonic activity is real. But I do believe there are other texts that speak to this. Let me just read to you, just for time's sake, you don't need to turn there. Deuteronomy 32, verses 7 and 8. Remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations, ask your father and he will show you, your elders and they will tell you, when the Most High, referring to God, gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind and he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. In other words, he's talking about what we read about in Acts chapter 17. God basically divided the nations and apportioned realms for peoples to live. He established the boundaries according to which mankind will live and be governed. And it says here, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. Now look with me at this paragraph at the bottom of page 4. We are told here that the Lord apportioned humanity into groupings according... Now, I don't know if you're reading another version, but some versions render this according to the number of the sons of Israel. However, in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, it's called the Septuagint, and in a scroll from the Dead Sea Scrolls from Qumran, it reads according to the number of the sons of God. Now remember who the sons of God are. That's an Old Testament phrase to refer to the angelic hosts. If that is correct, as many Old Testament scholars believe, the implication would be that the number of the nations of the earth is directly proportional to the number of angels. Certain groupings of angels are associated with particular countries and peoples. As F.F. Bruce put it, quote, the administration of the various nations has been parceled out among a corresponding number of angelic powers. The point being, when God created the nations and he divided the boundaries, he assigned a certain number of angels to oversee, in a certain sense, to guard and to carry out his will with regard to each of those socio-political units. Now, here's the question. Notice in the notes. If God originally made this assignment among the holy angels, it would not be out of keeping with Satan's character to copy it and to combat it. So again, I'm not saying this text proves the existence of territorial spirits. I think it does suggest the existence of territorial angels, holy angels assigned by God. By the way, this might help explain Revelation 2 and 3. Remember the seven letters to the seven churches? We talked about this in the first week, where the letter is addressed to the angel of the church of Ephesus, to the angel of the church at Smyrna, and the angel of the church at Philadelphia. Could it be that God assigned angels for the oversight and to the pursuit and the fulfillment of his will with regard to each individual local church? Or maybe a region of local churches? Entirely possible. So my point simply is this. If God did that with the holy angels, Would it not seem in keeping with Satan that in some way he has tried to copy that and to overcome it? So he assigns his demonic hosts to these particular national entities for the purpose of trying to exert a negative influence upon them. It's possible. Mark chapter 5. It's been a long time since we were in Mark's gospel, but let me remind you. Mark chapter 5, verse 10. This, by the way, is the story of the Gadarene demoniac. Remember the man who was in the cave and nobody could control him, and he kept breaking the chains that they tried to hold him down. And he was, when the demon spoke to him, he said, "Our name is Legion because we are many." In Mark chapter 5, verse 10, it says that Legion, this demonic group, begged Jesus not to send them out of the country. That's interesting. So Jesus is confronting this demon, heavily demonized man, and the demons say, all right, we realize we got to go. Don't send us out of the country. Why? Why is that such a big deal? Well, could it possibly be that they had been assigned to that particular region by Satan? And for them to be cast out of that country, to somehow be sent elsewhere, would have exposed them to Satan's rage for having, in a sense, abandoned their post, so to speak. I don't know. I don't know how else you can account for why they were afraid of being sent out of the country, except for the fact that's where Satan had put them for his purposes. There was a certain territoriality that they were exercising. Let me skip down to Revelation 2:13, again, just for the sake of time. You remember in the seven letters to the churches, the letter that was sent to Pergamum, an unusually wicked place. Listen to what it says in Revelation 2:12-13. "And to the angel of the church in Pergamum write, the words of him who has the sharp two-edged sword. I know where you dwell," Jesus is saying to his people there, "I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is." And then later down in verse 13, it says, "Pergamum is where Satan dwells." So, this city, which as I mentioned here, was infamous for its paganism, countless pagan temples given over to idolatry of all sorts. Could it be that Jesus is saying that at this particular time, may not have been all the time, but at this particular time in history, Pergamum was Satan's base of operation? It's where his throne is. It's where he exerts his most widespread and powerful influence. Satan dwells there. So the idea again of Satan or his demons somehow concentrating their activity in a particular national socio-political realm seems to have biblical support. Now, the question is this: what do we do, if anything, in response to this? Now, I'm not going to go into detail on this. I don't even say anything in the notes about it. But over the last, like I said, about 25 years, it really started, let's say, in about 1985. Number of books came out, conferences were held, Christians began to argue that in light of this territorial dimension to demonic activity, that if we want to see the gospel break through in our city or over a particular region, that we need to go in there and we need to study and pray and fast in order to discern who or what the ruling principality is. Just like there was one over Persia and there was one over Greece and maybe now there's one over Pergamum, let's just hypothetically say there's one over Oklahoma City. Maybe many. And we are called upon to discern its identity, find out its name, learn the ways in which it became entrenched over our region, and then collectively as the body of Christ basically challenge it to a fight. And basically, they would say that. We will go out, we will call upon and engage the demonic principality of this area and cast it down and demand that it leave, and so on. Now, the problem with that is there's not one single example of that kind of spiritual warfare in the Bible, Old or New Testament. You just don't find God telling us through anyone or giving us an example of a particular individual, whether an apostle or Jesus or anyone else, responding to the reality of territorial spirits in that way. Now, you will read stories, people who've written books who said, well, we did went out and did it, and man, we had massive breakthrough in the community. We just saw souls saved. We saw, you know, brothels closed, bars shut down, you know, revival among the teenagers, and well, I'm all for that. But are we really justified in drawing a cause and effect relationship between your engaging the so-called territorial spirits and the spiritual fruit that supposedly came about? Might it be that the spiritual fruit came about because the church mobilized itself in holiness and humility and faithful preaching of the gospel and repentance, and it is that which God honored with revival and renewal? Maybe it's because Christians in that community were doing what Ephesians 6 tells us to do, to put on the armor of God and stand against the enemy. So I don't want in any way to minimize whatever success, spiritually speaking, has occurred in these kinds of situations. But I just don't see any grounds for the kind of so-called strategic level spiritual warfare where we devote ourselves to trying to ascertain the name and the identity of these demonic principalities, and then we go out and somehow, you know, all gather corporately together. They, by the way, they did this in San Francisco on multiple occasions when that city was so well known for the entrenched homosexual community there. They thought this has to be the result of demonic activity. And you know, San Francisco is still pretty corrupt, but guess what? So are a lot of other cities in the U.S. I'm not singling out San Francisco or homosexuality. Please don't get me wrong. So my point is simply this. I don't find a biblical basis for strategic level spiritual warfare. I think the way we respond to this kind of demonic entrenchment is the same way we're supposed to respond to any other kind of demonic activity. Humility, godliness of life, repentance, prayer, fasting, worship, obedience to the Lord Jesus Christ, adorning ourselves with the armor of God in Ephesians 6, and standing firm. Now, having said that, I mention here in the at the end of these notes this thing called spiritual mapping. I'm not opposed to spiritual mapping. I can see where it might have some validity. So let me explain to you what it is if you've never heard of it before. Let's just read this real quickly, and then we're just about done. Spiritual mapping is an attempt to look beyond and behind the natural, material, and physical features of a city to the spiritual forces that give it shape and influence its character. It involves, quote, superimposing our understanding of forces and events in the spiritual domain onto places and circumstances in the material world. In other words, it's an attempt to discover the doors through which Satan and his demonic hosts gained access into and influence over a geographical locale, city, or nation. This supposedly will reveal the moral or legal grounds on which the stronghold is built, as well as the demonic spirit to energize it. So, I'll give you an example. You'll read where a community is just finding remarkable resistance to the gospel, just pervasive immorality, just all sorts of demonic activity, and they say, well, you know, we went back and we studied the history of the founding of our city, and we realized that in its past that it was actually done so in the name of Satan, that it was actually consecrated and given over to him. The founding fathers were involved in paganism and witchcraft. Or we have discovered that there were certain activities that were not only criminal, but morally barbaric and perverse that characterized the early stages of our city or our state. And could these not have been the open doors through which Satan gained a moral and legal foothold in our area? I don't doubt that that's the case. I don't doubt that that, in many instances, could certainly be true. So spiritual mapping in the sense of trying to discern ways in which a community or city might have exposed itself to demonic activity? I can understand that. But does that justify then coming in and engaging in this kind of strategic engagement with these demonic spirits and thinking that simply by going out and identifying them and denouncing them and telling them to get out of town, that therefore they're necessarily going to do it? I don't think so. Okay, let me read this next paragraph and then we'll open it up for questions. With this knowledge, intercessors, supposedly the knowledge gained by spiritual mapping, are better equipped to pray for the dismantling of the stronghold and to pursue other courses of action that will break the demonic influence and thereby open up opportunities for evangelization of the lost. Spiritual mapping is most often, but not always, based on an active and aggressive approach to spiritual warfare known as strategic level warfare. According to this view, the church is called to do more than simply stand firm, resist, and defend. The church is called to actively seek out, uncover, and confront the demonic powers that influence our corporate existence. And thus, a fundamental assumption underlying spiritual mapping is the concept of territorial spirits. I believe there are territorial spirits. I don't see anything unbiblical about the idea of spiritual mapping. I don't find any justification for strategic level, aggressive spiritual warfare in the way that many people do it. Okay, questions, comments? Yes.